Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, remembering Justice Stevens. And Richard, we take as our subject today the former Supreme Court Justice, John Paul Stevens. He passed away earlier this week at the age of 99, third longest serving justice in the history of the court, actually just barely missed being second. And he was, of course, Gerald Ford appointee to the court, came on after a tenure on the Seventh Circuit. And we'll talk in a moment about some of the cases where you think Justice Stevens had the biggest influence on the country. But before we do that, why don't you just give us a general overview of Justice Stevens? 35 years on the court is a very long time. How should we think in broad terms about his legacy?
Well, I mean, the first thing to remember is that since he died at 99 and was on, quote unquote, only 35 years, he was very much an important figure in the universe and Chicago life, in the city of Chicago. Before he was appointed to the Supreme Court, he was generally regarded as a very distinguished judge on the Seventh Circuit. His family came from circumstances. They owned what was the Stevens Hotel at the time, which I think has been absorbed in the, whatchamacallit, in the Hilton chain. He's pretty close to my turf. He went to the University of Chicago Laboratory Schools and graduated from there in the 1930s before he went into the service. In fact, my wife was responsible for arranging for him to get a sort of a award of merit as a distinguished alumnus, and we negotiated to find a way to bring him here. And that was the only occasion on which I actually met him in person. And, you know, he was unfailingly kind and generous and rather elegant in the way in which he captured himself. You mentioned that he was appointed by Gerald Ford. That is true, but there's a more important truth about this. The Attorney General at the time was a man named Edward Levy, who was the former president of the University of Chicago, who was also a University of Chicago product and a lab school product. And I actually, you know, was involved in a very tangential way with the process by which Levy recommended to Ford that Stevens be appointed. And this is one of these things where Levy, as he often did, made up his mind before there was any particularly broad examination of rival candidates. And then when the process was done, he ended where he started. Edward was an extremely adroit, shall we say, operator in the best sense of that word. He's very hard to read, very clear in his own mind, and extremely effective in getting what he wanted. And remember, he was regarded at the time, and rightly so, as a great attorney general because he cleaned up the mess that was left when John Mitchell had resigned, all the problems associated with Watergate and everything else. So then he gets on the court. And at that particular point, he's on the Seventh Circuit, and he's regarded very solid, very strong person. And his original reputation on the Supreme Court was as a kind of a maverick. And he didn't seem to have any clear sort of identity. And I could still recall in the late 70s and early 80s, everybody saying, well, there he goes again. There are eight justices who think in some conventional ways, and he's off on some particular tangent. But sort of towards the middle of his term, he did become much more focused and became much more liberal. He himself regarded himself as somebody who had not really changed his view, that the world had changed around him. I think actually that's not correct. There is a general tendency on the part of people when they get to the Supreme Court to become more liberal. And just to mention one illustration of a clear shift, in 1978, there was an exceedingly important case decided called Penn Central, written by Justice Brennan, which essentially established a very deferential standard for the review of restrictions on land use as opposed to the occupation of land. And Justice Rehnquist wrote a very strong dissent, and Justice Stevens, in fact, concurred in that dissent. By the time you get a couple of years later into the mid-80s and you get property rights cases, Justice Stevens is quit, clearly on the other side of the issue, emphasizing not property rights, but the need for planning commissions to have the ability to make coordinated and rational efforts in the way in which they run these things. So that's an illustration, I think, of where it turned out that he shifted. Obviously, he tends to be known not for cases like Penn Central, which he didn't write, tends to be known for the cases that he did.
Right. And we'll talk about some of those. In fact, we should start it now. And I'll just note up front that, as always, this is a show dedicated to intellectual inquiry. And we're considering Justice Stevens' legacy as a jurist here, not as a person. So I don't want any of our listeners to think that we're being insensitive insofar as we talk about areas of the law where you and he may have disagreed. He'd probably appreciate the debate, actually. And so in that spirit, Richard, let me start with a topic that we've touched on many times on the show in the last several years. The administrative state. One of the central decisions that informs the current state of play there is Chevron versus NRDC from 1984. And it was
1984, yes. And National Resource Defense Body. So it's an environmental group.
And it was Justice Stevens that wrote the majority opinion there. Richard, our longtime listeners will know you don't particularly care for this ruling. Well, walk us through what you think it gets wrong.
Okay, well, first of all, let me walk through what actually happened. Justice Stevens regarded this opinion as a rather moderate opinion. And indeed, relative to the opinion below, which was written by the then Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg, it was, in fact, quite moderate. What at issue in the particular case was a program whereby, in trying to figure out what was a point source under the environmental statutes, did you aggregate several chimneys from the same plant or did you keep them separate? And under the Carter administration, this program gets put forward sort of, and Ruth Ginsburg basically says, as far as I'm concerned, you don't meet with the proper purposes of an Environmental Protection Act, so I'm striking down all this kind of program. Thing then gets up to Stevens in the same period, as Ruth wrote this in the early Reagan years. He follows it, and he reverses her and allows the plan to go through. But he does so on the following ground. He says, if the statute's clear, you follow the statutes. The statute's not clear, you defer to the agency to let it decide, given its expertise, as to whether something should or should not be allowed. And so he said, looking at this particular situation, there are several ambiguities that he found in the statute, and therefore he said that the Reagan administration could go through with its program to treat all of these smokestacks on a single plant as though they were one. So it is more conservative than what the D.C. court had done before that. But in the end, it turns out it's really an extraordinarily complicated opinion, because the first question you always have to ask is, what do we mean by ambiguity, or is that term actually ambiguous? So the difficulties that you get with respect to Chevron is that, first of all, you treat this as though it's a kind of an agency question of fact when it's clearly a question of law. And one of the striking features about the Chevron opinion is there is a section which says, questions of law to be decided by the judges under the Administrative Procedure Act. He never bothered to quote that section or to explain why it turned out it wasn't applicable. So it's a kind of a statutory netherland. And then he wasn't very good in explaining why the statute was actually ambiguous in terms of its particulars. And in future cases, what typically happened is that you saw cases in which things were regarded as more and more ambiguous so that the agency had the last say over everything. And some of the times it was really quite extraordinary on what you can do. So to give you an idea of what deference can do for you, there's a famous case called Rapanos and an earlier case called Bay River, Riverview Homes, or some such title like this. And at issue in these cases was the question of, what do we mean by a navigable water of the United States? And if you're going to basically read the term, a navigable water is on something which you could float a log or a boat down. But if you in fact do what the government wanted to do when pressured by environmental agencies, uplands, which essentially feed water into navigable rivers, are themselves navigable rivers. And Justice Stevens wrote in one of these cases that that was just fine by him. If the, it turns out that the experts wanted to say that a navigable river covered land that drained into a river, it was fine. And so then we get a bunch of cases in which some guy who's on dry land 2 miles from a river is told that he has to get a building permit from the Department of Rivers and so forth, and they can't get that because there may be some leakage from this dry plot of land into the river. And this creates an enormous amount of difficulty. So with people like Justice Gorsuch and like Justice Kavanaugh, and I'm on their side on this one, they regard this as a misapplication of the rule. Judges normally decide questions of law. They do it in ordinary trials where they're very complicated facts. Why can't they do it for an administrative body? Congress is not allowed to tell courts how to decide cases. The judicial body is separate and autonomous from the federal body, and the unpredictability that you get with this discretion and the flip-flops you get from one administration to the other means it's a mistake. And just last term, in a case called Kaiser, it turned out that discretion in another area related to this, which is the deference that the courts give to federal agencies in interpreting their own regulations, virtually every single justice, including Justice Kagan, who was the most favorable to the government, tightened up on the particular standard. So I have no question that Chevron is in for a major redoing. The Supreme Court is always kind of strange in the way in which it works. In this recent case called Kaiser, the earlier case known as Allen Robbins was very substantially changed without any explicit acknowledgement of that taking place. My guess is the same thing will happen to Chevron. But make no mistake about its importance. This case is cited more than virtually any other case in the last 100 years. It's cited much more, for example, than Marbury and Madison and other rather insignificant cases in the course of our history.
Towards the end of his tenure in 2007, Stevens also wrote another consequential opinion at the intersection of environmental law and administrative law. That was Massachusetts versus EPA. This is the famous case about whether the EPA had the legal authority to regulate carbon dioxide emissions. He joined in this with Justice Kennedy and the, at the time, three Democratic appointees on the court. Break this one down for us.
Well, this is it's the anti-Chevron case. As I said to you earlier, Chevron is a highly unpredictable and very malleable doctrine. And what happened in this particular case is that the EPA was given the authority to decide whether or not a certain substance should be treated as a carcinogen or a pollutant because it contributed to various kinds of harmful effects with respect to public health. This was in connection with motor vehicle standards. And what happened was the Bush administration looked at the stuff and said, we don't think there's any particular problem. It's a scientific question, not a question of law, and we just don't see the evidence. There were many briefs written, including that by the state of Massachusetts, attacking this. And all of a sudden, now Justice Stevens finds that this statute is sufficiently clear that the administration is duty-bound to decide whether or not it's going to issue an endangerment finding on the question of whether or not carbon dioxide is a pollutant. And it just doesn't fit the statute, because when you talk about pollutants like noxious gases of one kind or another, sulfur dioxide, what you do is you have relatively small quantities which can be fatal. Every one of us breathes out every day about 2 tons of worth of carbon dioxide. So if you apply the standardized limits for what counts as a pollution to carbon dioxide, every single person is a major facility needing environmental regulation. So the only way in which you can make the thing work on the inside is to change the limits that the statute puts into place to something which essentially keeps most small kinds of operations out from under. So if this is a pollutant, you can't do that. The other thing, of course, is carbon dioxide is not a pollutant like the other ones. You drive most pollutants to zero and you think it's a very good day. If you drive carbon dioxide to zero, everybody is dead. There is a huge debate to this very day as to what is, quote unquote, the optimal level of carbon dioxide. As you well know, I'm on the doubter side of this. Right now, we're moving from 350 to 400 and something, say 410, in the last 30 years. I think it's had only a negligible effect on the environment. There are many people who think it's been quite the opposite way. It's a sort of a hard fact question. But when Justice Stevens wrote this, it was quite a remarkable opinion. He says, well, scientific evidence has established that greenhouse gases have all these toxic effects. And it just turns out it was a vast oversimplification of what's going on. And so what you really need to do is to understand that where you give administrative agencies some degree of discretion is on expert determinations of fact rather than on the question of what do we mean by a smokestack or a point source or something like that. I thought he got it wrong in a very bad way. The Obama administration came out with an endangerment finding in 2010. It has been attacked very severely. Many people want to simply undo the thing. I'm one of those people who thinks that they just never made out the case. It's well understood today, whether you like it or not, that all of the models that predicted some kind of global warming as a function of carbon dioxide have overemphasized predictably what the effect has been. If you think of these functions as supposed to be monotonic, that is, carbon dioxide always increases, temperature always increases. The record just doesn't look like that. In 1998 and 2016, we had very sharp peaks. They had nothing to do with carbon dioxide. They had to do with La Nina, that is the lack of the normal cool winds. They were replaced by warm winds in a regular cycle. Temperatures go up. at the moment it's over, it goes down. So in 2016 to 2018, we had the two consecutive years of the largest drop in global warming or in global temperature in the last 100 years. That's not consistent with the general scenario, widely unreported. And I think, in effect, that Stevens was wrong. This is an expert question. I think the Obama administration was entitled to make its particular judgment, subject to various kinds of criticism as to whether or not there's substantial support. But I thought the decision turned out to be wrong. And I think that the endangerment finding is a fairly serious mistake. And this, too, has become extremely controversial at this particular point in time. There are many people who think that it's getting worse and worse. But I would say there's a rising percentage of scientists who actually now are on the more skeptical side, thinking that many other things, from sunspots to various other kinds of solar phenomena, are responsible for the large changes in temperature, not the 15% increase in carbon dioxide, which in fact is reduced to about 3% if you take into account that two-year drop, 2016 to 2018.
The last thing that I'll ask you, given the fact that he was a Republican appointee, Justice Stevens drew a different kind of attention when he staked out what were perceived to be more liberal positions. And the two fronts on which he drew the most such attention, especially from the press, were campaign finance reform and gun control. I know that as a legal matter, as distinct from a policy matter, you thought he was right about one of those and wrong about the other. Map those out for us.
Yes. Well, the gun control case is the Second Amendment case, a case called Heller against Washington, D.C. And Justice Stevens wrote a dissent. He credited his law clerk in the Atlantic article, Kate Shaw, for having done the work, which she indeed do. I thought it was an extremely powerful historical defense that completely outdid Justice Scalia's opinion on his favorite originalist grounds. If you look at the text of the amendment, you know, a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It looks like a very mysterious provision. You've got two clauses, each 14 words. What are they supposed to mean? Well, if you ask the National Rifle Association, the first clause doesn't mean anything. Because when they put the Second Amendment on their entryway into their Washington, D.C. offices, they have three dots for the first clause and they only have the second clause there. But Justice Stevens was quite right to say that the two clauses work together. And in 1986, it turned out I had to become, in spite of myself, an expert on the militia clause. I was asked by the National Guard Officers Association to address this issue in conjunction with sending various troops overseas in the Reagan administration. And so they called me up and said, "We understand, Professor Epstein, you're an expert on the militia clause." And I looked at them. I said, "What's the militia clause?" And then they come back to me, "You know the militia clause." I said, "You mean the Second Amendment?" They said, "No, we mean the militia clause." Well, it turns out I then had to read the militia clauses. And the Second Amendment is essentially an adjunct to the other provisions, which talk about how it is that the states are in control of the militias, how they train them in accordance with a discipline that is a training regimen specified by Congress. They can be called up into national service only for three purposes: insurrection, a disunion and rebellion, things like that. They can't be sent overseas, and they can't be called up by the president unilaterally. He has to be given authorization by Congress to be able to do it. And so what's the Second Amendment about? If you look at this, it's obviously, as Justice Stevens said, it's a federalism provision, a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state. What happens is this clause was meant to bind the federal government, not to bind the state. And it left the states free as they chose to regulate gun usage and in whatever way they happened to think was appropriate. And so the clause has nothing whatsoever to do with a naked individual right. It has to do with this federal arrangement. If that's the case, then two things follow. One is that it has no application to Washington, D.C., which is where the Heller case arose, because Washington, D.C. is not a state, and so therefore there's no interaction. And also, it doesn't bind the states so that they are essentially forced to do this, because the whole point of the amendment is a federalism provision was to give the states whatever freedom they wanted on that particular issue. Justice Scalia, I thought, missed both of those questions. Then he realized that you cannot possibly treat the clause, the last 14 words, as though it were simply an isolated command. There had to be some justification for restricting weapons. So he invents a police power justification, which is nowhere in the text. So I thought Stevens nailed it on every single point. And I still think it that way. I disagree with Stevens on one issue. He thought that if you gave the states the freedom to regulate, they would actually be able to reduce gun usage and deaths. I'm very skeptical of that particular claim. There are lots of complexities associated with it. But it seems to me that if you're thinking seriously about this issue, the one principle that you should always observe is to make sure that your politics on gun control are not driven by your constitutional views or the other way around. It's perfectly consistent to say, I think Stevens is right on the constitutional issue, but wrong on his prediction about the effectiveness of gun control. Look at Chicago. We have terribly strict gun control statutes and massive killings all around the city because it's easy to get guns in from Indiana or from other places where it's legal to sell them and just simply to bring them across the border. So I give him very high marks on that opinion. I thought it was really a splendid job. I might say amongst conservatives, I'm somewhat of an outsider on that particular issue. The other case I assume that you're talking about is Citizens United. And the question is whether or not you can have regulation on campaign finance. And, you know, it's Scalia versus Stevens again. And I think the outcome is a TKO, but in the opposite direction. I think that Scalia actually, in his concurrence, wrote a very strong opinion. What the First Amendment says is that Congress shall pass no law abridging the freedom of speech. This was, of course, a federal statute, so you're not worried about what the states would do under the First Amendment. And what Scalia's position was, sure, we did not have corporations in the modern form in 1789 when this was passed, but the provision is written in the passive voice, shall make no law restricting the freedom of speech. You certainly can't restrict it for individuals. Suppose you say you can't restrict it for the press, and then a newspaper incorporates like the New York Times, you're going to say, oh, now that you're a corporate party, you don't get any protection because corporations weren't protected in 1787, 1789. They're not protected today. Of course they're protected. Why is that? Because you don't want the state privilege of incorporation to come at the cost of the sacrifice of your federal constitutional rights to speak your own mind in whatever way. Well, then the question is, if you say that the corporations are covered, is there a justification for these restrictions? And recall what was restriction. This was a showing of the movie about Hillary and all the things that were wrong with her. And they wanted to show it relatively close to the primary. And the statute said within 30 days of a primary, you can't make a political speech of this particular sort. And this is absolutely backwards. Now, the time at which political speeches are most important is, in fact, when elections or something like that turn on it. And so what happens is Justice Stevens gets these things exactly backwards, as far as I'm concerned, by trying to cut out speech when it's needed most. Well, then the question is, well, maybe the speech would be corrupting. Well, there were two answers to that, and he never got either of them right. One of them is there are all sorts of statutes already in place which are designed to deal, for example, with campaign contributions made by government employees. You don't allow that, and I think that's correct in many cases, and so you don't get that. And then there are all sorts of general prohibitions that deal with bribery and things of that sort. You certainly don't allow those. So the question then you have to say is, given all these other restrictions that you have in place, can you show any kind of serious abuse that requires this absolutely blanket prohibition on this kind of speech? And he just comes up very weak. He finds, you know, one case 40 years ago where there may have been some improper speech. Well, you're talking about a general regime. You have to show a welter of cases in which everything starts to go wrong. Why can't you do that? Well, the simple explanation is there's lots of times that people want money to influence speech, but they're not all on the same side. When Citizens United was written, you know, about 10 years ago and so forth, generally speaking, people thought, large corporations tend to be Republican. Check that against Amazon, Facebook. I mean, they're all liberal. The Microsoft, they're basically Google, are all left-wing corporations. I still don't think that you're entitled to restrict them. And I think that what he did is he really wanted to set people off on the wrong track. The progressive view was you have to keep money out of politics. That's what Stevens wanted to quote. And I think the response to that is as follows. You can't keep money out of politics. It will come in one way or another, so long as the federal government or the states have huge discretion to do what they want. So think back to what I said about property rights and environmental law, for for a second. This government can essentially decide that a navigable river is a tiny little thing, a river, or it can decide that it's half the countryside. And if you go through any one of these cases that deal with that or with zoning, public discretion is enormous. And the only way in which you're going to be able to stop the political abuses is to tighten up the definition of property rights so they become more protected, more definite, less contentious. And what happens is Justice Stevens essentially missed the first half of it on the property rights stuff, and he had unquestioned faith in the ability of expert administrators to make land use decisions, something I vehemently disagree with. And then having decided that, he wants to stop political campaigns. And that, of course, is going to mean that some people are going to have access to other means and other people are not. I think his opinion was actually quite weak on that circumstance. And I don't believe that he would have decided it that way in 1975. I think he became more liberal as the country became more sensitive to the campaign contribution issues by the time we reached 2010. So, I mean, he always writes interesting opinions. They're always thoughtful. But that doesn't mean, in my view, that they're correct. And I think he probably wrote more wrong decisions than right decisions. But the mark of a good justice in many ways is not whether he gets it right or wrong, but whether or not it gives you food for thought.
All right. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.